A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about shipping lines, the apex predators of global logistics. There's a sprawling universe of freight forwarders out there consolidating cargo. But the actual companies that own and operate the container ships? That's a very short list. His question is straightforward. Who are they, and what portion of global freight does each one actually move? But the implications here go way beyond a list of names. This is about who controls the arteries of world trade.
The asymmetry is staggering when you sit with it for a second. There are roughly 50,000 merchant ships on the water right now. Tankers, bulk carriers, container vessels, the whole mix. But the container shipping industry, which is the part that actually moves the finished goods economy, is controlled by fewer than a dozen companies. Not 50,000 players, maybe 11 if you're being generous.
Which makes this one of the most concentrated industries most people have never thought about. Trucking is fragmented. Thousands of owner-operators, regional fleets, warehousing is fragmented. But the ocean leg, that's an oligopoly, and it's getting tighter.
The timing matters. We're coming out of a period where the Red Sea disruptions forced carriers around the Cape of Good Hope, absorbing about 10% of global container capacity. Before that, the pandemic rate spikes. Before that, the Ever Given blocking the Suez. Every shock that hits global trade gets filtered through these 10 companies. So understanding who they are, how much they control, and what their incentives are, that's not shipping nerd trivia. That's essential literacy if you buy, sell, or move anything internationally.
Let's define the scope before we name names. We're talking about container shipping lines, the companies that own and operate the vessels carrying those standardized steel boxes you see stacked on ships, not bulk carriers moving grain and ore, not tankers hauling crude. Container shipping is the circulatory system of global supply chains, your iPhone components, your furniture, your clothing, your industrial inputs.
The key metric here is TEU capacity. TEU stands for 20-foot equivalent unit. It's the standard box size. A 40-foot container is 2 TEU. Market share in this industry is measured by share of global TEU capacity deployed. As of mid-2026, the global container fleet sits at roughly 30 million TEU. That's the pie. And a very small number of companies own most of the slices.
Before we get to who, let's clear up a misconception. Daniel's question hints at shipping lines and freight forwarders are not the same thing. Forwarders are intermediaries. They buy container slots from the lines and resell them to shippers. They consolidate cargo, handle customs paperwork, manage the logistics chain. But they don't own the ships. The lines own the ships. If you're a small importer and you book through Flexport or Koenig & Nagel, you're still ultimately riding on a Maersk or an MSC vessel.
That distinction matters because the forwarder market is genuinely competitive. Hundreds of players, low barriers to entry, lots of specialization. The line market is the opposite. The top 10 carriers control roughly 85% of global container capacity. The top 5 control about 65%. That's not a market, that's a club.
Which makes you wonder how we got here. Container shipping used to be more fragmented. National carriers, smaller regional lines. But the economics of scale are brutal. A single new-build container ship costs upwards of $150 million. The latest ultra-large vessels, the ones that carry 24,000 TEU, can run over $200 million. If you're not operating at massive scale, you can't compete on slot cost. So the industry consolidated, wave after wave of mergers and acquisitions, until we arrived at the current structure.
The alliance system turbocharged that consolidation without technically being mergers. Let me explain how that works, because it's one of the most important and least understood parts of this industry. Carriers form vessel sharing agreements, alliances, where they pool ships on specific trade routes. So Maersk and Hapag Lloyd might jointly operate a Asia-Europe service, each contributing a certain number of vessels, and they share the container slots. This lets them offer weekly sailings without each carrier having to deploy enough ships to cover the route solo.
Which sounds efficient, and it is. But it also means that on any given route, the number of independent service providers is even smaller than the number of carriers. If three carriers are in an alliance together, they're coordinating schedules, capacity, and effectively pricing. It's not a cartel in the legal sense. These agreements get regulatory approval. But it's not exactly cutthroat competition either.
Right. And the alliance landscape just went through its biggest reshuffling in years. Until early 2025, the industry operated in three alliances. There was 2M, which was Maersk and MSC. There was Ocean Alliance, which was CMA, CGM, COSC, OSC Alliance. And there was The Alliance, which was Hapag-Lloyd, 1, HMM, and Yang Ming. That was the map for years.
Then 2M announced it would dissolve, which was a seismic shift because Maersk and MSC together controlled about a third of global capacity. The divorce became official in early 2025.
Out of that dissolution came two new structures. Maersk partnered with Hapag-Lloyd to form the Gemini Cooperation. Meanwhile, O1, HMM, and Yang Ming formed the Premier Alliance. Ocean Alliance, CMA-CGM, COSCO, and Evergreen stayed intact. So we went from three alliances to three alliances, but with very different membership and very different route coverage.
The Gemini Cooperation is particularly interesting because Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd are designing it around a hub-and-spoke model. The idea is that mainline vessels call at fewer ports, the hubs, and then smaller feeder vessels handle the connections to secondary ports. The pitch is higher schedule reliability. The trade-off is more transshipment, which means more handling, more complexity, and more things that can go wrong.
That's the structure. Now let's get to the actual names and numbers, because this is what Daniel asked for. Who are these companies and how much do they control?
The big three, historically, have been Maersk, MSC, and CMA-CGM, but the order has shifted. As of mid-2026, MSC is the largest container line in the world with roughly 20% global market share. That's about 6 million TEU of capacity. MSC is privately held, based in Switzerland, founded by the Aponte family, and they've been on an absolute tear.
MSC's expansion is one of the wildest stories in the industry. Since 2020, they've added over 2 million TEU to their fleet. That's like adding an entire Hapag-Lloyd on top of what they already had. They did it through a combination of massive new building orders and aggressive secondhand purchasing. When rates spiked during the pandemic, MSC had the cash flow to buy practically anything that floated. They overtook Maersk as number one in early 2022, and they haven't looked back.
The used ship buying spree is the part that doesn't get enough attention. Most carriers focus on new builds. Custom ordered from the big shipyards in Korea and China, takes 2 to 3 years to deliver. MSC was out there buying 10-year-old vessels from smaller lines that were exiting the market. They didn't wait for shipyards. They just absorbed capacity that already existed.
Maersk is number two at roughly 15% global market share, about 4.5 million TEU. Maersk is Danish, publicly traded, and they're the most famous name in container shipping, the Coca-Cola of the industry, basically. But they've made a deliberate strategic choice to cap their fleet growth. They're not trying to be the biggest anymore. They're trying to be something different.
This is the integrator strategy. Maersk is pivoting hard into logistics, warehousing, trucking, air freight, customs brokerage, end-to-end supply chain management. The idea is that owning the whole chain is more profitable than just owning the ocean leg. So while MSC is buying ships, Maersk is buying warehouses and logistics companies. Whether that bet pays off is one of the big unanswered questions of the next 5 years.
CMA-CGM is third at roughly 13%, about 3.9 million TEU. French, family controlled by the Sade family. They've been aggressive on new buildings, and they're particularly strong on the Trans-Pacific and Asia-Europe routes. They also bought Siva Logistics a few years ago, so they're pursuing their own version of the integrator play, just less loudly than Maersk.
Then the next tier. COSCO Shipping, which is a Chinese state-owned enterprise, controls roughly 11% of global capacity. That's about 3.3 million TEU. And the state-owned part matters enormously, which we'll come back to.
Hapag-Lloyd, German, about 7%. 1. Ocean Network Express, which is a Japanese consortium formed from the merger of three legacy Japanese carriers, about 6%. Evergreen, Taiwanese, also about 6%. Then you drop to HMM, South Korean, around 3%. Yangming, Taiwanese, around 3%. And ZIM, Israeli, around 2%.
That's basically the industry. Those 10 names control 85% of global container capacity. Everyone else, and there are smaller regional carriers, niche players, is fighting over the remaining 15%.
What's fascinating is how the order book is going to reshape these rankings over the next few years. Market share isn't static. The carriers with the largest new building order books right now are MSC, CMA CGM, and COSC. They're going to gain share through 2028. Maersk's order book is relatively small because of that integrator pivot. They may actually lose share relative to the others.
Which is a strategic gamble. If freight rates stay elevated, Maersk leaves money on the table by not having the capacity to capture volume. If rates collapse, they look smart for not being overexposed to a commodity business. The bet is that logistics margins will be more stable than shipping margins. History suggests they might be right. Shipping is famously boom and bust. But the counterargument is that the industry has learned to manage capacity more aggressively.
That's the perfect segue into the consequences. Because the structure we just laid out isn't just industry trivia. It shapes pricing, geopolitics, reliability, and the cost of everything you buy.
Let's start with pricing power. In a competitive market, when demand drops, prices drop. When demand spikes, carriers add capacity, and prices moderate. That's the textbook. In an oligopoly, the incentives are different. If you're one of five carriers controlling a trade route and demand softens, you can idle ships. You can slow steam, reduce vessel speed to absorb capacity. You can blank sailings, cancel scheduled voyages. None of this is illegal. All of it supports rates.
We've seen this play out in real time. After the pandemic rate spike, when freight rates hit $20,000 per 40-foot container on some routes, demand normalized in 2023 and rates collapsed. But they didn't collapse to pre-pandemic levels, and they didn't stay collapsed. The Red Sea crisis gave carriers a supply-side justification to raise rates again, and they did, aggressively. But even without a crisis, the structural incentive is to manage supply to keep rates above the cost of capital.
The pre-pandemic normal, 2010 to 2019, was an era of chronic overcapacity and low rates. Carriers were losing money, consolidating, and burning through cash. The industry learned a hard lesson. The post-pandemic normal looks different. Carriers have discovered that they can, collectively, exercise pricing discipline. And when 10 companies control 85% of capacity, collective discipline is a lot easier to coordinate.
Second big consequence, geopolitical leverage. COSC is a state-owned enterprise of the Chinese government. Its 11% share means China directly controls a critical choke point in global logistics. If there were a Taiwan contingency, a blockade, a conflict, COSCO's fleet becomes a strategic asset. Federal Maritime Commission has flagged this repeatedly. The EU has scrutinized COSCO's participation in Ocean Alliance. This isn't theoretical.
It's not just Costco. China's influence extends through port ownership, too. COSCO owns terminals in Piraeus, in Valencia, in Long Beach. The Belt and Road infrastructure push is partly about securing maritime choke points. So when we talk about shipping line concentration, we're also talking about where the physical infrastructure of global trade sits and who controls it in a crisis.
The third consequence is service reliability. During the pandemic, schedule reliability collapsed to around 30%. Think about that. 7 out of 10 ships were late. For shippers running lean inventories, that was catastrophic. As of mid-2026, reliability has recovered to about 70%. Better, but still means nearly 1 in 3 sailings is delayed.
The alliance reshuffling we mentioned creates transitional instability. When you redraw the network map, new hub ports, new feeder connections, new vessel rotations, there's a period where things break. Shippers are reporting longer transit times and more transshipment as carriers optimize for cost over speed. The Gemini Cooperation's hub and spoke model, for example, might improve reliability on the mainline legs, but add complexity at the transshipment points.
The fourth consequence is the carbon regulation squeeze, and this one is going to accelerate concentration further. The IMO, International Maritime Organization, has targets for 2030 and 2050 emissions reductions. The EU has its own emissions trading system for shipping, which began phasing in during 2024. FuelEU Maritime adds another layer. The practical effect is that older, less efficient vessels are going to become more expensive to operate.
Maersk estimates that carbon costs under the EU ETS will add 200 to 300 euros per 40-foot container on Asia, Europe routes by 2027. That's a direct cost increase that hits every carrier. But the carriers with modern, fuel-efficient fleets and the capital to invest in dual-fuel vessels that can run on LNG, methanol, or ammonia absorb that cost better. Smaller carriers with older ships get squeezed. The likely outcome is more consolidation, not less.
The dual-fuel transition is a genuine capital barrier. A methanol-capable new build costs a premium over a conventional vessel. Maersk has ordered a series of methanol-powered ships. CMA CGM has gone big on LNG dual fuel. MSC is hedging with both. If you're a small regional carrier with 10 ships built in the early 2000s, you don't have the balance sheet to play this game. You either get bought or you exit.
The forces pushing toward concentration are mutually reinforcing. Economies of scale favor the big. Alliance structures favor the big. Carbon regulation favors the big. Geopolitics favors the big. The question isn't whether the industry will consolidate further. It's how far it goes before regulators push back.
On the regulatory front, there's an interesting tension. The EU has been relatively hands-off on shipping alliances, granting them block exemption from competition rules. Federal Maritime Commission has gotten more aggressive under the Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 2022, but their tools are mostly about unfair practices, detention and demurrage charges, service contract disputes, not about breaking up concentration. Nobody is seriously proposing antitrust action against the top carriers.
Which brings us to the practical question. Given all of this, what should someone actually do with this information? Daniel works in logistics and tech. He's not just asking for trivia. So let's get concrete.
First actionable insight. Know your carrier's alliance and order book trajectory. If you're shipping on a carrier with a shrinking relative fleet, and right now Maersk is deliberately capping growth while MSC and CMA CGM are expanding, you may face tighter capacity and higher rates in 2027 and 2028. This isn't speculation. The order book numbers are public. MSC has roughly 1.5 million TEU on order. Maersk has about 400,000. That gap is going to translate into very different service profiles.
Second, diversify carrier exposure. Don't put all your volume on one alliance. The Gemini Cooperation and Ocean Alliance have different route structures, different hub ports, different service profiles. If something goes wrong in one alliance's network, a port strike at a hub, a vessel casualty, a cyber attack, you want your cargo split across different systems. It costs more to manage multiple carrier relationships, but the resilience is worth it.
Don't just assume the alliance you've always used is still the best fit. The Gemini Cooperation's hub and spoke model might be great for reliability on major port pairs, but terrible if you're shipping to a secondary port that now requires a feeder connection. Ocean Alliance has more direct port coverage on some routes. The service maps changed in 2025. If you haven't reevaluated, you're operating on stale assumptions.
Third insight, more for the investor side. The shipping line oligopoly is structurally bullish for incumbent carriers. Barriers to entry are rising. Capital cost per new build, regulatory compliance, port terminal access, the alliance system itself. You can't just buy a ship and start a container line anymore. The incumbents have a moat, but the risk is demand destruction. If rates stay elevated, shippers eventually redesign supply chains, nearshoring, friendshoring, shorter routes. Container shipping volume isn't immune to price elasticity over the long term.
One more misconception to address head on. There's a tendency to think the pandemic shipping crisis was a one-off, that rates are back to normal and we can stop thinking about this. The rates are lower than the peak, yes. But the underlying structure that enabled those rate spikes hasn't changed. The oligopoly is still there. The carriers learn that capacity discipline works. The next shock, whether it's a Taiwan blockade, another pandemic, or a carbon tax escalation, will be filtered through the same concentrated industry. The normal of 2010 to 2019, with chronically low rates and overcapacity, may not return.
The other thing that doesn't get enough attention is how carrier concentration interacts with port concentration. The top 25 ports handle something like half of global container volume. When you have concentrated carriers serving concentrated ports, the system has very little slack. A disruption at Shanghai or Rotterdam or Los Angeles Long Beach cascades instantly, because the same few carriers are calling at all of them.
The Red Sea crisis was the live fire exercise for this. When Houthi attacks forced carriers around the Cape of Good Hope, it absorbed about 10% of global container capacity just from the longer transit times. Carriers with larger fleets, MSC and CMA, CGM, could redeploy vessels faster to cover the gaps. Smaller carriers had fewer options. The rich got richer, essentially, because they had the fleet depth to adapt.
One last thought to leave you with, because this story isn't over. The question that keeps me up, well, it would if I didn't nap so effectively, is whether we're heading toward a big two. MSC is at 20% and growing. CMA CGM is at 13% and also growing. Maersk is deliberately stepping back from the capacity race. If the current trajectories hold, we could see an industry dominated by two European headquartered giants with a Chinese state-owned player in third. What does that mean for shippers? For national security? For the price of everything that moves in a box?
Will regulators eventually step in? The EU has been remarkably tolerant of shipping concentration so far, but at some point the numbers get hard to ignore. FMC has more tools than it used to. There's a scenario where the industry consolidates to a point that triggers the kind of antitrust scrutiny the tech giants faced. But shipping is less visible than tech. It's the invisible industry. So it might get further down the consolidation road before anyone notices.
Which is exactly why Daniel's question matters. Most people can't name three container shipping lines, but these 10 companies determine whether your shelves get stocked, whether your factory gets inputs, whether your online order shows up. They're the silent partners in every global supply chain. Knowing who they are and how much they control isn't industry arcana. It's knowing who moves the world.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Kabadi subvariant called Amar, popular in parts of Western India during the late 1600s, was played with no out rule. Raiders could stay across the midline indefinitely. The variant went extinct by the early 1700s and was only rediscovered in 2023 through a passing reference in a Marathi merchant's ledger found in a Dutch archive.
A merchant's ledger?
That's one way to rediscover a sport.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We're back next week with whatever Daniel sends us.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.